Welcome to Indie Radio Garden. My name is Lois Volta, and I'm so glad to let you know that this week, Indie Radio Garden is highlighting two stories from Philadelphia.
This program brings ordinary citizens to the air to discuss issues related to health, race, safety, workers' rights, and the will to survive in pandemic times.
The first audio from WPEB 88.1 Scribe Radio is from the show Jubilee Voices. Now, the hosts from Jubilee Voices are a group of kids in third and fourth grade. They're 8 and 9 years old, and they are awesome. Their names are Aya, Shayna, Kevin, Kaylin, and Kennedy. And they aren't afraid to ask some big questions. They interview Waida Cook, Mumia Abu Jamal's wife, and his close friend Lynn Washington about the incidents of Mumia's trial and the harshness of a life in prison. We will present the interview in two parts.
Hello, West Philly. This is Jubilee Voices, and today we will be interviewing Lynn Washington, a dear friend of Mumia Abu Jamal.
Can you explain Mumia's trial and how it was unfair for Mr. Lynn Washington?
Yes. Hello. Thanks for having me. The matter involving Mumia Abu Jamal, the gross injustice, is something that I'm very familiar with. I had the pleasure and honor of actually working with Mumia. We were both journalists. He was a radio journalist. I was a print journalist back in the late 70s. And then since his arrest on December 9th, 1981, I followed this case. Let's just say I followed it very intently. I've read just about every piece of paper that any lawyer has filed, records, witnesses, all of that. So your question is the trial, and was the trial fair? According to a number of persons who've observed this and studied this, including Amnesty International, Mumia's trial in 1982 was not fair at all. It violated the majority of his fundamental fair trial rights. Amnesty International, in fact, said that it did not meet minimum international standards for a fair trial. To have a valid conviction, you must have a fair trial that produces that. And if your trial is unfair, then the conviction that comes out of it is unfair. I mean, here we had a judge in the particular trial who, before the trial started, saying that he was going to help prosecutors fry Mumia. And he used a very derogatory and racist term. Throughout the trial, he favored the prosecution. And I'm talking about the judge, Judge Albert Szabo. And it was so bad that Szabo's antics became an appeal item. And as this case went from trial into appeal, various judges have bent and broken the law to sustain the conviction. And that's not only at the Pennsylvania court level, both the Superior Court and the Pennsylvania Supreme Court, but also in the federal courts, the federal district courts, the federal appeals courts, the circuit courts, as well as the U.S. Supreme Court. Incredibly, the first time that the word justice was used in relation to Mumia's case was only in the last couple of years when a Philadelphia judge ruled that there was enough evidence of improprieties by a member of the Pennsylvania Supreme Court as well as local prosecutors to give him a new trial. So that's just a short summary of this very complicated and convoluted case that has spanned now 4 decades.
Thank you. My next question is, why was Mumia elected to be the president of the Philadelphia Association of Black Journalists?
My recollection is that his term was actually expiring in December of 1981. He announced some new directions for the organization to try to make it more relevant in terms of addressing the needs of the African-American and other communities of color. and utilizing journalism. And as a part of that, it was critical of the lack of coverage and the biased coverage that communities of color were receiving at the time. And he also, during his presidency, made an effort to get more fair and equitable employment practices in the media, something that we see today in 2021. Just a few months ago, the Philadelphia Inquirer commissioned an audit to examine its coverage practices and its employment practices. And this audit found that the Inquirer was not covering communities of color, and that they were doing a very poor job with their employment practices. So the very things that Mumia Abu-Jamal fought for as president of the Philadelphia Association of Black Journalists in 1981 are things that continue to persist in the media.
Okay, thank you. That was all my questions.
So my name is Shanajita Nali, and I also have a question about Mumia.
Okay.
So my question is, who gave him the courage and who inspired him and gave him the courage to fight for our rights?
Ah, very, very good question. When you look back at Mumia's history, you see that he was definitely inspired by the Black Panthers. When you see his activism in high school and seeking to change the name of Ben Franklin High School to Malcolm X High School, you see that he was inspired by that person, as so many of us were in that era. Mumia is a scholar. I mean, this is one of the many extraordinary facets about him. So over the years, I mean, he studied African philosophy, Far Eastern philosophies, European scholars. So he has what we see now today is a composite of many people who have been inspirational to him. And parallel to that, Mumia has been inspirational to thousands of people worldwide. So I guess the short answer to your question, one would be the spirit of activism from the 1960s that was embodied in the Black Panther Party movement and Malcolm X. And while I have not talked to him specifically about this, I would also venture to say that a man named Franz Fanon, who was a psychiatrist originally born in Martinique in the Caribbean, he was very influential on many young African-Americans in the late 1960s going into the 70s with his ability to see the power in the persistence of racism.
Thank you. How is it being Mumia's wife?
It's bittersweet. It's sweet because of Mumia is such a beautiful and loving person and soul and spirit. And it's hard because we've been physically separated for 38 years, going on 40 years. So that's been very rough, as you very well know. You see me by myself. That's your grandfather. That's your papa.
That was a perfect answer. So what was Mumia like?
He was a very fun, loving family man. And he's still alive. And he's very innocent. Yep, he's beautiful. Yeah. He was fun. He used to carry your mom on his shoulders. And he would have Tot on by her hand. And we would walk around and go to picnics and concerts. And
that seems like fun.
It was really fun until that date, December 9th, 1981. He loved to play in the rain with us. We all played in the rain. We played games. He loved making pizza for the girls, meaning your mother and Tot. He would make pizza for them. He would cook for them. For us, you know,
mm-hmm.
He loved reggae music. He loves any kind of music. He would come second to only my father as far as being a beautiful and loving husband and father and grandfather.
My name is Kevin Ishmael King.
Hey, Kevin.
I have a question that either of you can answer, but my question is, what do you believe Mumia's main goal was to change or make better in the Black Panther Party or in the world while he was in the Black Panther Party?
To definitely make change, to be equal is what he was trying to do. I know that's a short answer, but it's the truth. He's a revolutionary, so when the government would mistreat us, he would help to bring awareness to the people.
Yes, that was perfect. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you.
Hello, my name is Kenalyn Augustine.
Hi, Kenalyn.
Berlin, Washington. How has the Black press changed over the years?
The Black press has always been an advocacy vehicle. And from that perspective, you can see from the journalism of Mumia Abu-Jamal, the effort to expose injustices and find ways to eliminate those injustices. The Black press in America began formally in 1827. And from that time, it has sought to do what the mainstream media claims that is doing, and that's informing people of things going on around them and serving as a watchdog on power. So how has the Black press evolved, changed over the years? Just like all media, they've incorporated technologies. They've tried to do better at what they do. But one of the things, one of the problems that we have seen continuously is that the Black press gets second-class treatment, not only from the other media in the wider society, but increasingly is getting second-class treatment even from the Black community. The fact that, the Philadelphia Tribune is struggling to survive now in a city where there's hundreds of thousands of Black people says something not good about the ability of the Black community to support institutions that have historically supported them. And I would say the same with WURD Radio, Black-owned radio station serving the community. They do have a membership structure, but the membership structure is very similar to subscriptions to newspapers. That radio station should be flush with business as well as wealth, given the size of the listening audience that they have.
I also wanted to ask, have you visited Mumia in jail? And if you have, what is prison like on visiting days?
I have visited Mumia while he's been incarcerated. I haven't been in the last couple of years. As Wadia could tell you, visiting a prison is a very emotional enterprise. And it's bad enough if the person is guilty, and it's just horrible when the person is not, when you know that the person is innocent. Some of the worst times that I had doing visits with him was when he was at SCI Green and he was still on death row. And the death row part of that prison was literally a prison within a prison. You would have to walk through the prison, out into a little yard, and then into a separate building. And while the persons on death row were separated from all the other persons, when the visits took place, you were sitting on one side of a glass wall, in effect, and the person you're talking to, in this instance, Mumia, was on the other side. But where I'm going with this is that when Mumia and other prisoners who were on death row were let into these facilities, these rooms where they could talk, they were handcuffed and shackled at the waist, and then they had a chain on their handcuffs that went through a loop on their waist down to their ankles. It was very clearly a a method of oppression and to do harm. Think about this. You're inside a prison within a prison. Surrounding this is like a 12 or 20 foot wall that's topped with barbed wire. Why was there a need to have these people chained the way they were, if not to just further try to grind up their personalities? So it was really difficult. And whenever I would come out of visiting him or other prisoners, it was just like a dark cloud was there. And sometimes I would just sit in the parking lot for a minute to try to collect myself, because it was really a jarring experience. And then to see how other people were mistreated, other visitors were mistreated. And you can't say anything, because if you open your mouth and say, this is wrong or that's wrong, I mean, there's a possibility they might arrest you and try to put you in the institution. So I'm sorry for the long answer to your very short and very perceptive question. It's very difficult to visit people in jail. Jails are not nice places. You hear politicians say, we got to make it tougher for people in jail. Well, none of those politicians could last 5 minutes in jail because they're just very ugly, hellish places.
WRGULP, Germantown United CDC, shares audio with us on the Neighborly Chats program. David Juro interviews David Thornburg, chairman and CEO of the Nonprofit Committee of the 70. He talks about the conditions that citizens have found in voting for the primary election on May 18th.
You're listening to Neighborly Chats on WRGU 92.9 FM. Today's episode is a chat with David Thornburg from the election advocacy nonprofit Committee of 70. Stay tuned during this special installment of Neighborly Chats to hear some details about the upcoming May 18th primary election.
My name is David Thornburg. I'm president and CEO of the Committee of 70, which is a longstanding nonprofit, nonpartisan organization that promotes better government and better elections in Philadelphia and in Pennsylvania. We have an office down in Center City on Broad Street. You know, we get out and about a lot talking to citizens groups and community leaders, and particularly around election times. If folks know anything about the Committee of 70, it's our involvement with elections, particularly educating citizens and encouraging participation. And elections are our sort of Christmas and New Year's every year. The Germantown connection actually is my wife and I lived in Germantown for about 7 years, great years. Our first child was born there. We lived in West Central Germantown. We still live in Northwest Philadelphia. We lived in Mount Airy and now Chestnut Hill. And it's the best part of the city and one of the best urban spots in the country, if you ask me.
David is only the latest president of this organization, as it's one of the oldest of its kind in the country.
Well, I would be 117 years old if I had founded the Committee of 70. So I am just the latest in a series of folks who are trying to shepherd the organization along and into the future. It's got an interesting history, though. It's one of the first kind of civic good government groups in the country. When we were founded in 1904, it was a real innovation. And it was basically founded by business and civic leaders who were concerned about the state of politics. Our elections were chaotic and violent and a mess. And they were concerned about the leadership that was emerged from those elections. We were also dealing with a very challenging situation where Philadelphia had recently been recognized as the most corrupt and contented city in the country, which to these upright businessmen, and they were all men, let's be straightforward about it, it really rattled their confidence because it's not good for business, it's not good for citizens, it's not good for local democracy. Our leadership is still drawn from those quarters. Although we're much more diverse, about half of our board members are women and are about a quarter are people of color. And we have worked hard to see that our leadership reflects the makeup of the city, which is, you know, an ongoing challenge.
This last year has, of course, been an incredibly difficult one for the United States in general, and it was no different for the Committee of 70.
Well, 2020 may have been the most challenging election in our 117-year history. There's no two ways about it. It was an extraordinary year in terms of what we call delivering democracy. And we knew early on, and this is not a partisan statement because we are a staunchly nonpartisan organization, we knew that Philadelphia had to deliver a quality election or things were going to get really bad really fast. That needed to occur to make sure that the mail voting process went well, that in-person voting sites were identified and well-staffed, and that there was a huge challenge in educating voters about historic changes in the voting process. A lot changed in the way that Pennsylvanians and Philadelphians voted last year. About 40% of voters voted by mail, which was about 8 or 10 times more than had ever happened before. And that brought a lot of challenges in educating voters using social media, using online chats, all of the above, just to make sure they signed the right thing and used the right envelope and dropped off their ballots beforehand. And then we also knew that our local election apparatus had to work well. And we spent a lot of time basically advising them and helping them to organize their work, attract some outside funding to acquire the equipment that they needed to process this avalanche of mail ballots. And we take a lot of pride in the work that we did because, by and large, it worked. There's a third thing, actually, I should throw in, which is to advocate for reforms that make the process more fair, more accessible. I'll give you two examples. One is there's a lot of concern for a long time about partisan gerrymandering, which is the process of drawing election maps done once every 10 years to favor one party or one politician over another. And we've been involved in pushing back against gerrymandering for the last 3 years. We have a terrific program called Draw the Lines PA, which is sort of a massive experiment in citizen participation. We equip Pennsylvania citizens with the software and the data they can use to draw maps for themselves. And we have twice annual competitions. And in the last 3 years, we've had over 6,000 people participate, learn how to draw maps, and in doing so, take some ownership for the process. Between now and basically this time next year is when we will draw new maps for Congress, for our state legislative offices. And a lot of folks don't realize it, but district council offices, because the population changes and shifts. So that's one issue. And then the other one is opening up primary elections to independent voters. Pennsylvania is one of a double handful of states that prohibits independent voters from voting in candidate primaries, which we think is just wrong and unfair. There are more so-called independent voters in Philadelphia than there are registered Republicans. And they basically get to do nothing in this primary election and in all primary elections until we can change that. It seems counterintuitive to think that not all voters get to participate in the primary elections that they pay for. So there's something wrong with this picture, and you know, we're trying to make it right.
This is when we started to discuss the upcoming primary election on May 18th.
Fast forward to the coming election, May 18th, Tuesday, May 18th. We'll be electing a city controller, a district attorney, judges, both locally and statewide. We'll also be electing election board workers to staff the city's polls over the next 4 years, and also voting on some very important statewide ballot questions. So for a different set of reasons, we have our work cut out for us, making sure that voters know what's at stake, why it matters, why their vote matters, and frankly, trying to refocus their attention on local issues and not get caught up in the swirling dust clouds of partisan nonsense that too often drown out the sun.
I asked David about some important issues he thinks voters should be looking out for on the 18th.
Let me just highlight these two ballot questions that would seek to change Pennsylvania's constitution. And it's a result of, let's just say, a tug of war between our legislature in Harrisburg and the governor about who gets to control the declaring of emergencies, which the governor did in this pandemic, and who gets to end them. So it really could alter the balance of power on that important question. It's not one that we've taken a position on. I just want folks to understand what's a consequence, because those two ballot issues, if you vote in favor for them, essentially give the legislature, which is 253 people, a great deal of power in making consequential judgments about how and when declarations of emergency are issued and when they're rescinded and how that can affect our daily lives. If you vote against, you're affirming the present constitution, which gives those powers to the governor, which some would argue is a more efficient and maybe accountable capacity or power than dispersing that among 253 legislators. So I really urge your listeners to pay attention to that one.
I asked David about some of the interesting people that he met during his time working for Committee of 70.
A couple of years ago, my car broke down and I called AAA, and a tow truck driver picked me up and towed the car, and I got to ride with him in the cab for about a half an hour. And it turned out he was a very active, I think he was a block captain or a local committee person in North Philadelphia, just felt passionately about the need to educate young people and bring them into the process and talking to neighbors and, you know, talking to his faith community. He was a gentleman who was very aware of the sacrifices that many had made over the years to ensure the right to vote. He felt it was his mission to carry on that work and not let that courage and that action go to naught. And I love that conversation, because it just demonstrated, like, that's how this works, is where folks all along the socioeconomic spectrum take an interest, get involved. You know, in terms of the Black Lives Matter and the civil unrest of last summer, I think it's obviously a reminder of how much work there is to be done in this country at a local level, national level, and everywhere in between. And I think it's redoubled our commitment to making sure that the right to vote, which is also a responsibility to vote, continues to be sort of the most important message that we can carry forward across communities.
Finally, David told me about some of the important initiatives that have been started and largely grown via social media.
We, a year ago, launched a campaign called We Vote, basically encouraging people in organizations, whether that's community organizations, companies, labor unions, block associations, to act together to become more active citizens, not just voter registration and turnout, but to understand what it takes to be an active citizen. We've been working, we had over 100 groups in the last campaign sign up to be We Vote campaign partners, and that continues to roll forward in this primary election and ongoing. Interesting thing is, you know, it's opened up a lot of opportunities. We've been making active use of Facebook Live, interviews done through Zoom to educate citizens about candidates and issues, and the We Vote campaign has been largely virtual and digital. So we figured out a way to adapt. Ultimately, we're trying to make voting and citizenship a part of the culture of families, neighborhoods, organizations, universities. And it's a long-term pursuit, but we're making good headway, and we're very proud of that effort.
Please listen to the following resources if you're interested in learning more about the work the Committee of 70 does.
If you want to learn more, of course, you know, our all-purpose website is 70.org, and we'll walk you through the particulars and everything else that's on the ballot. I encourage you to like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter, Instagram, or whatever platform you're using. We have been doing candidate interviews for the municipal primary here. I just did an interview on Facebook Live with Rebecca Reinhart, who's the current controller and running again, and also with Chuck Peruto, who is the Republican candidate for district attorney. We've also had a great group of Philadelphia high school students who have been interviewing judicial candidates and others, which is a great opportunity for them to kind of step into the limelight. I'd encourage your listeners to go check us out there.
I'd like to thank David Thornburg of the Committee of 70 for taking the time to talk to me. And I'd also like to thank you, the listener, for tuning in. My name is David Juro, and you've been listening to Neighborly Chats from WRGU 92.9 FM.
Thanks so much for joining us here at Indie Radio Garden. My name is Lois Volta, and I'm the host of Confessions of a Cleaning Lady from the Volta Way. that airs on WGGTLP, Germantown Community Radio. Indie Radio Garden is a Prometheus Radio Project production.